I want to, before we get started, or as we get started, to thank our sponsors for this evening, Shear, Stephanie Magnet and Morty Shapiro here in Toronto, sponsoring it in memory of Stephanie's father, Alan Eliyahu Ben Levi Dov, whose yahrzeit is Erev Sukkos, I believe. So the neshama should have an aliyah, long life. We should come together for happy occasions, and I want to thank them for sponsoring the Shear. He's a big fan of yours, Mark, as you know, Morty, so that's why he likes to always sponsor one of your Shear. Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you. And just to remind everyone, so we'll meet today and then we don't meet till 3 weeks, right?
Correct.
And after...
We're not into, Shabbos Zoom stuff. Yeah, we're in, that's not...
Yeah. And I'll actually be away in the great state of Florida for the last days. But just a reminder to everyone, we're in, I think when we get back after Sukkos, most of our shuls will be back to normal, doing regular things. So if any of you are machers and you're involved in planning the schedule speakers, we don't do Zoom on Shabbos, so we still have to have live speakers. So remember me if they're looking for someone and they don't have anyone else. I'm happy to come. And that reminds me because I got my first email for the new year about this, so be happy to do it. Okay, I have a few minutes to say before we continue. We don't have very long. It won't be this class, but probably the next class we will finish with the unit we're doing, and then I want to do Zachariah Frankel for a few classes. But I just want to actually, before we even finish the unit, probably next class, I'll get to all the questions and comments people have sent me. I have a bunch, but let me just go through for 10 minutes quickly. Here's a book you might recognize, although you can't really read it. Very big, thick one. Louis Ginsberg's commentary on the Jerusalem Talmud. I think it's four volumes. One was published posthumously, actually edited by David Weiss Halivni. I mention this only because I said about davening five times a day. So those who are interested, if you look in volume one, page 72 and on, he deals with an interesting matter. He tries to show, we know we all daven three times a day, but his argument is that originally we daven five times a day. What do you mean five times a day? If you look at the sugya, and he quotes the Gemara Rishonim, originally Shema was said, and then later you said Shema, for example, when you woke up, Nates, whenever you said it, then later you daven Shemona Esrei, and the same thing in Ma'ariv. So you have Shema, Shemona Esrei, then you have Mincha Shemona Esrei, and you have Shema for Ma'ariv, and then you have Shemona Esrei. Later, they insisted on Tekef Elul Tefila, that you everything is connected, you Shema, the Brachos, and then you do put it together. So he goes through the whole sugya there, so that's how it leads us into three davenings. But then he says, Im naniach she'obi mihamorayin lo samchu gulo tefila, he says, if we're going to assume, which is his argument, that already, even the time of the Amoraim, you had people, he thinks it's only the Vasikin, the very pious ones, who would be so mechula tefillah, but everyone else still daven, they did Shema, they did separately, so five separate tefillahs. He said, that answers the question that a lot of people have had, namely, where does, he calls him Mahmud, I think today we would say Mahmad, where does Muhammad get this idea of five davenings, five prayers a day? They have five prayers a day. Originally, Muslims used to face Jerusalem even, until they changed it. So, Ginsberg puts out a theory that maybe this goes back to the old, before they joined the Shema of Shacharis with Shemona Esrei and the Shema of Ma'ariv with Shemona Esrei, when they were actually considered separate tefillahs, that's maybe the origin of the Muslim idea of five davenings a day. I don't know if it's correct. Anyone's interested, like I said, you could check out Ginsberg's points, which is quite interesting. Slichos, just about at the end. Okay, I did a little research on Slichos. Many, many people emailed me about Slichos, about the Rav and other things. I would have found some of it already, but let me tell you what I have here and vibe, et cetera. So let me pull up some things on my screen here for everyone. One second.
What I got here on my screen?
Actually, I have a bunch of things. Before I even get to the Slichos, thank you. I forgot who sent this to me. Oh, Tzvi, I think it is, sent this to me. This is, remember I quoted Yeshaya Leibovitz about Mashiach? So, hold on, let me show you this again. I just want to share the screen with the sound. Hopefully my sound now is going to work. This is exactly what I mentioned. Let me get this. Here you go. Hopefully we'll hear it now. Okay, so there you got it. For some reason, I think my sound, it works fine, but when I connect with all the people on, I don't know why that should matter. Here's also, let's say if we get good music, a musical slichos. Now, for some reason, I don't know what it is. My computer, it doesn't really connect. I have Migdalos, their musical slichos. For whatever it is, my computer now, when it's connected to all these people on, I have a problem. I can share the screen, but the sound isn't so good. Okay, but I can send you to it. What I want to show you is the question that was raised about Slichos. So first, the Rav's position. We heard from Rabbi Kelman and others, the Rav's position, absolutely, that it has to be after Slichos. The question is, what did he do with Maisa? If you look in Nefesh HaRav, Mipnine HaRav, pages 155 to 156, he explains, or Schechter explains, that the Rav was upset. He says it has to be, Slichos has to be after Chatzos. It's not correct. What mitzas kilos, what some kilos are doing, when they're doing it after Ma'ariv, before Chatzos, he cites the Rambam. The Rambam says in Hilchos Tshuva, Perek Gimel, that the minhag was to, the minhag, not alach, the minhag was to wake up early and do divrei tachanunim. So he compares that to Slichos. And he mentions that Slichos after Chatzos is already mentioned by the Me'iri. And he also says that it doesn't matter the first night or the other nights. But then Rav Schechter says, later on, when the Rav was older, when he was not healthy, and he couldn't get up early, he couldn't stay up, then he would daven with a minyan after Ma'ariv, even though he still said it's not correct. And Rav Schechter writes that once in Boston, before Rosh Hashanah, Motzei Shabbos, after his drasha, this is Saturday night, he says, let's do Slichos now. So they asked him, why it's not Chatzos? He's always so strict on that. And he says, well, first of all, by the time we get to Tachnun, it'll be Chatzos. And Rav Schechter says that he sensed that he only did this as an emergency measure because he was worried that otherwise people would go home, they would go to sleep, they wouldn't come back, they wouldn't do it. Rav Moshe Feinstein says the same thing. Rav Moshe uses the word ho-ra-sha, which means that if you're not going to get the people to come, you can do it before Chatzos. Interestingly, Rav Schechter cites, he says, see the book Mayanei Yeshua, from Rabbi Yeshua Hirshhorn. Now, Rabbi Yeshua Hirshhorn, we have some people from Montreal who listen to us. This is in number 23. He was the Rav, I think he was considered like the official Rav of Montreal, if they have such a position. And he also has the tshuva on this about saying Slichos before Chatzos. And he's more tolerant of it. He says that this is a common practice. He says among Hasidim, he says that... And he sees reasons to do it. If the people are not going to, it's going to be hard to get the people. He thinks that the real issue is if you're a yachid, And you want to say it not to. Now, Rav Avadia discusses it as well. Many discuss it. And at the end of the day, it's Kabbalistic reasons. That's what they all point out. That's why, if you look at Yechav Hadas, volume 1, number 46, he begins saying, Tam HaMinhag, the reason that we nagu amar sichos dafka bashmaras haboker velo b'tchilas halayla, it's based upon what it says in the Zohar. And then he cites the Ari, who's very strict on this, and others who's very strict on it. But he cites Rav Moshe, who says that if you need to do it, you can, because this is not found, Rav Moshe says, in the Gemara. It's only from the Achronim, Api Sifri HaKabbalah. So, and then Rav Avadi actually cites a Limud Chos, that if in Israel it's already past Chatzos, then you're okay. So basically what I've learned is that it's definitely better to do it after Chatzos, but in a situation that you can't get people to come, and most people are not going to come, it's going to be a problem. There's room to be matur this. And finally, thank you, Ruvain, for sending me a response of Wattenberg of Paris. He cites the book Keter Shem Tov. Keter Shem Tov is a work, if any of you are Sephardim, you might particularly find this interesting. It covers all the Sephardic minhagim from all over the Sephardic world. And in volume 4 to 6, the number, it's included together, page 13, he cites that the minhag of London was you would do slichos, also you do it after mincha, they would do it. They would do sichos. Why? They're not going to come early in the morning. That's when the Sephardim would do it. So therefore, you do a slichos katsar, a small slichos. You do it in the evening. Okay, there you go with that. Two more minutes. Moshe mentions that perhaps this is related to Tikkun Chatzos, that originally Tikkun Chatzos would have been from Chatzos and on. And let me read actually what he says here, that he says that the time for Slichos is not on time for Tikkun Chatzos. The original time was before dawn and not after Chatzos. So that maybe this all goes back, the whole business of saying it at Chatzos comes from Tikkun Chatzos. I don't know. It bears investigation. He mentions there's an article by the late Eliot Horowitz. Eliot Horowitz wrote a few very interesting articles, and one that became quite famous, in which he showed that the whole idea of Tikkun Chatzos, staying up on Shavuos night, it's all because of coffee. When coffee comes, that's what gives people the ability to stay up. And they mention in records of it that we'd stop and we'd drink the coffee. Okay, I already see it's time. I do want to get to, I'll get to this next time. If I have to, I'll do it at the end. Another case of Jewish murder, the royal family. Is it really true that they circumcise by Moalim? And also, I'll get to next class. Eric, your question about intermarriages. Is marrying non-Jews actually a Torah prohibition, or is it only a rabbinic prohibition? And it appears to be a machlokes. It seems to be machlokes between the Rambam and the Torah, although Rabbi Blech, as I'll show you, wants to say that even the Torah would agree with the Rambam. But I already see it's 8:45, so I will get to that next class. Let us pick up with all the good things we have to do today. If you recall, we ended last class. We're in the middle of the Breslau Conference, the third and the final of the Reform conferences. I think the last thing I spoke about was the opposition to any return to Zion, and that's not our mission. Rabbi Yaakov Yellen emails me that a couple of sources that it's not just, I mentioned that it continues, this opposition to what we call Zionism, return to Israel. And he sent me a couple of things, including from a recent auction. Here you have a leaflet, a group of Reform rabbis in opposition to the Balfour Declaration. And he sent me another one also, image from the CCAR, also against the Balfour Declaration. It wasn't just Reform. When Rav Kook was in London during the time of the Balfour Declaration, when it was when it came out, and there were Jewish leaders of the assimilated type of English Jewish leaders who were putting pressure on not to issue it. And in Rav Kook's opinion, these were traitors. They were guilty of treason. But there were many Jews who thought that this would raise the specter of dual loyalty. And that was the case in England. For the Reform rabbis, as we saw, this is part of the Jewish mission, that we were not going to return. That's an era, a time where Jews lived in the land of Israel. That time has passed. And now we're moved on to a different era. For example, in the Chicago rabbis, what they say is the ideal of the Jew is not the establishment of the Jewish state, not the reassertion of Jewish nationality, which has long been outgrown. The mission of the Jew is to witness to God to all over the world. So the idea that we'd return to the land of Israel and be our own nation again, that's going back in time instead of going forward in time. And here is what David Einhorn said. David Einhorn was a radical reform. I think I pulled up here the Wikipedia page, if you see his picture. Do I have it here? Yes, here's David Einhorn. David Einhorn, he comes to America and becomes rabbi in Baltimore. The synagogue he becomes a rabbi in Baltimore, I think it's still existing. It's still existing. Mount Sinai, it's called. It's the oldest congregation in the U.S. that has used a Reform prayer rite since its inception. What that means, it's the oldest synagogue in America that's been Reform originally from 1842. There's other synagogues that are older Reform synagogues, but they did not begin as Reform. They began as traditional synagogues and then moved to Reform. So David Einhorn, who he was a radical reformer, he comes to America and he says as follows. He said this when he was in Germany, though. He said it already at the Frankfurt Conference. Quote, "The collapse of Israel's political independence was once regarded as a misfortune, but it really represented progress. Not atrophy, but an elevation of religion. Henceforth, Israel came closer to its destiny. Holy devotion replaced sacrifices. Israel was to bear the word of God to all corners of the earth." So that's, we've spoken about this last class. I don't need to go into it anymore. But here we have the idea of chosen people. Chosen, not chosen as special, as better, or chosen for service, to spread the word of God to all corners of the earth. You will see Orthodox Jews. Hirsch also speaks about a mission, but I think it's pretty common. If you go to the typical Orthodox Jew, and I don't only mean if they're in apologetic mode. I once brought a group of Scranton people to a rabbi, and one of the persons asked them this question about the chosen people idea, and he gave this answer. But I even think if it's not, I think it's become very fashionable, even not in an apologetic mode, that chosen for service, chosen to be a Kiddush Hashem, to spread the idea of the one God. And that's, after all, that wasn't that what Avraham was supposed to do? So it's not just the reformers. Now, the Breslau Conference dealt with some other issues. And one of them I'm sure you'll find fascinating. They dealt with mikvah. Why would the Reform Conference deal with that? Especially as within, it wasn't an issue for that most of them, and it wasn't going to be an issue at all very soon. But remember what we described, how in the small towns, you often had rabbis, traditionally trained rabbis, who went over to the Reform side. But they're the only rabbi in the town. And there's a synagogue, there's a mikveh and everything, and they're the communal leader. So the town is still a traditional town, and basically it's a bunch of ignoramuses, amoratsim in the town, whatever the rabbi tells them they'll do. But they're it's not like in the big city where they're more sophisticated, and we're the Reform temple, and over there There's the Orthodox. No, there's one community. And this was still an accepted practice there. So what they ruled for those people who still followed it, which in the cities you wouldn't have had any, but in the towns you still would have had. Remember, these are traditional people who are not so sophisticated. They ruled that drawn water, water that's drawn, you carry all this stuff, lime shuvim, is still valid. So what this means is that when the rabbi comes back to the town, he can tell the people that from now on, no, we don't need to worry. We can use drawn water. And what do the people know? The rabbi told them, and that's it's something which you will not have in later years, but in these early years, you still have reform rabbis take Frankfurt, take Hamburg. None of the people who are going to the reform synagogue are observant. So the reform rabbi is not really affecting any halachic changes for the people. But in the small town, you still have people who are halachically observant. They're eating kosher. They're doing everything they used to do. And the rabbi is able to tell them that now you can a different style mitzvah. You can go. You can eat. You don't have to observe Yom Tov Sheni. All the things we're going to speak about. That's why I said that the rabbis, the reform rabbis in these small towns, could do real damage in a way that could not be done in the big city, because in the big city, the people going to the reform synagogue had already left traditional Judaism. And in the this is my argument, which I don't think is radical. But I think it's factual that in the big cities, reform was actually a positive thing in the sense that it kept the Jews connected to Judaism for one or two more generations. That is, in the big cities, these were people who were not going to synagogue anymore. They had rejected traditional Judaism. Tzunz describes how people who had never been to synagogue in years were coming to the reform temple. So reform is actually preventing assimilation. That's in the big cities, but in the small towns. And this I didn't mention in the last semester. In the small towns, though, they actually did have the ability to alter people's practices. People who until then had been traditional would be moved by them. So when I said that Reform Judaism, to a large extent, you have to look at it as really a barrier against assimilation for people who had given up traditional Judaism, that is true with the cities, but in the small towns. Now, most of the reform rabbis, you didn't have that many in the small towns, but you did have a number. And then you later would have the what we call conservative. Later you had more. But even in the first generation, you still had a number of rabbis who as I said, could have real influence in small towns. What about circumcision? We learned already that Geiger thought it was barbaric. They took this up at the Breslau conference, and the delegates rejected the idea that we should get rid of bris milah, which I guess is it's a big step, because no one in Germany is having circumcision except for the Jews, and wider society sees it, agrees with Geiger that it's, quote, a barbaric bloody act. That's what Geiger said. It's a barbaric bloody act, and yet they still had enough Jewish connection that they refused to get rid of bris milah. Today, I don't know what the reform today is. I mean, most in this country do it. Pretty much everyone in America does it. I don't know. I don't think they require it for conversion. And in Europe today, this is something unusual, which is very different in America. If you go to a place like Hungary, for instance, the typical Jew who's not observant is not circumcised. Whereas in America, everyone is circumcised. It's an amazing phenomenon, but that circumcision is not regarded as important in many places in Europe. But to their credit, the Breslau Conference rejects the abolishment of circumcision, or the requirement, I should say, of circumcision. They said you need to circumcise your children. There were plenty of Jews who were not. But the reform movement said you must. There was polemics against. There were Jews who refused to circumcise the children. The question was, can you bury them? Can you make a decree that the father who doesn't circumcise his child, the kid cannot be, the father cannot be buried in a Jewish cemetery? And there were rabbis who said, absolutely, you can do that. There's a whole piece about Rav Soloveitchik about this. Rav Chaim apparently disagreed. He said not circumcising is a sin. However, what does that have to do with, you don't then punish them in another way? And the Rav said that the other rabbis were really correct in terms of public policy. By the way, Geiger himself never publicly called for the abandonment of circumcision, but in a private letter, we know his feelings. Actually, I'm still talking about Frankfurt. All the thing with what I just mentioned about the drawn water is not Breslau; it's Frankfurt. So take that back. And also the Bris Mila. Okay, then let's get to the Breslau conference. I got confused for a second there. I thought we were finished with the Frankfurt conference. Now I see we weren't. The Frankfurt conference, which is the last one in what 1846? Yes, 45. No, 46. This was the most moderate. 12 days again. These are real vacations here. I'd love to see if they were in some fancy resort or something, but this focused to a large extent on the Shabbos, the Sabbath. And it's here where we discussed hold time a few classes ago, made his famous suggestion that the Sabbath, Shabbos, should be moved to Sunday. His colleagues opposed him, though, and it was never even brought to a vote. Meyer, in response to modernity, on page 139, quotes a great statement by one of the Reform rabbis there, Leopold Stein. He says, to transfer the Sabbath to Sunday would be to bury Judaism on Friday in order to resurrect it as another religion on Sunday. That basically, it's a nice play there on the play on words, I guess. We're going to just bury Judaism on Friday and resurrect it on Sunday. So again, I have to give credit to the Reform rabbis who refused to go along with moving it to Sunday. What was Holtheim's point? Holtheim's point, which made sense for people who are not observant, he says, now that we're living in a non-Jewish society, since most Jews are not able to observe the Sabbath on Saturday, because what does it mean to observe the Sabbath? They're not worried about malacha the way we think of it, but still to go to the synagogue, to have family time. No, they're working. They have to work on Saturday. And the point of Sabbath is to sanctify time to God. It doesn't matter what day it's on. If you can't do it on Saturday, you do it on Sunday. Not because Sunday is the Christian day, the whole Lord's Day or anything like that, because Sunday is the day off. If the day off was Wednesday, then you do it on Wednesday. And if you want people to come to the synagogue and you want people to sanctify a day of the week, Holtheim's point was, and remember, Holtheim's a Talmud Chacham. Holtheim's the one I showed you. There's a tshuva to him from one of the Poskei Hador. And he's the one. It's like if you're all the way on the right, when you give it up, you go all the way to the left. He's arguing that what's important is not the day, but the concept of the Sabbath. It's interesting that the reformers in the mid-19th century were so tied to the Sabbath on Saturday, because in the 1930s, there was, I think it's the 30s or the, it's the 30s. There was a whole movement by, I think I pulled it up here. Yes, there was a whole movement to move the calendar. Here it is. It was 1920s. In the 1920s, the League of Nations considered a system called the World Calendar, which enabled a given date to fall on the same day of the week every year. This resulted in days being skipped or added, which meant that the Jewish Sabbath would not occur every seventh day. There was a whole plan that you want to make a good calendar. First of all, you wouldn't need our calendar's all messed up. The days come on different times. We have different each month is different. So they wanted to fix it. Now, as far as I know, this was not an issue for the Reform. They never protested, but the Orthodox had a huge problem with this, because if all of a sudden you had one day that skipped, like let's say this week, Tuesday is skipped. It's not a day. It's just like we give it a different day, Nature Day or whatever you call it. As far as we're concerned, it's still the seventh day of Shabbos. But as far as the world is concerned, Saturday and Sunday, the weekend, are going to be our Sunday and Monday, but that's going to have enormous implications on people who work. So the Orthodox really got all their guns together and a lot of pressure, and they got the Vatican. Believe it or not, the Vatican went along with this because they argued that it would hurt Sunday. Sunday should remain Sunday, even though it's not really an Ikar Amuna for them. Joseph Hertz, Chief Rabbi Hertz, was very involved with this, and he wrote a little memoir published in 1932 called The Battle for the Sabbath at Geneva. And they were successful. And the Sabbath was not changed. That is, the calendar was not changed. And I haven't heard anyone speaking about changing it. You know, Napoleon had a different calendar in France after the, not Napoleon, after the revolution. Sorry. They had a different calendar. A lot of people have these ideas, different calendars. Yeah, a calendar, just like they had ideas when we were growing up to get rid of those of us in America, get rid of our system and go with the metric system. Of course, the metric system makes more sense. 32 ounces and 12 inches. I mean, where do you get these numbers from? But look, we're tied to it. We like it. And we refuse to go along with it. I remember when I was in elementary school, they were pushing it. The science teacher told us within 5 years, all the signs are going to be taken down. They're all going to, no more miles and all that. And we stood strong and said, and you know, Gezerah, even from the American government, a Gezerah that isn't spread is not a valid Gezerah. And just like we wouldn't accept the new Coke, we said, no, we want our old Coke. We would not accept this metric Gezerah. It might be a bad system, might not make sense, but we like it. It's our system. And as far as I know, no one's interested in trying to push to change the calendar. There is another issue, though, which it's like, I don't know how you can win on this, but they're trying to. With the daylight savings, they're trying to make it so they never, so that it's always daylight saving. So maybe you can't daven shacharis to like, 7:30 a.m. You can't start it sometimes. And that's a problem, because what do? People have to commute. And they have to commute, and they can't leave, let's say, till 8:30. I mean, how can they have to be at work by that time? It is a big issue. But if this seemed to have so much value, so when kids come home from school, it's light and sports and all this, making the argument, which they were making, this is, if you haven't heard much about this, but a few months ago they were arguing to the elected officials that's going to affect our prayer times and everything. It doesn't seem like it's a winning argument. You got to come up with something better than that. Those of you coming with me to Morocco, we'll have some late days, because they're always on like an extra hour. So our shacharis, so you get a little extra sleep than normally on my trips. And by the way, getting back to now the reformers of the Breslau Conference, not only did they reject moving the Sabbath to Sunday, but they put forth a proclamation, and sometimes these proclamations are just, I don't know how much effect they had, but it's still valuable, that we need to make the Sabbath a day for religion. You need to make it a day, a God's day. That's something that in the Orthodox world we don't need to stress. I don't think... Well, I'll take that back. I guess the rabbis do stress it, because maybe they think that on Shabbos, although people follow, there's a Zohar and there's a Shomer. So they don't violate any of the, you cannot not violate any of the malachos on Shabbos, but your whole Shabbos, there can be no Jewish content other than maybe Kiddush. So I guess the rabbis can also speak about, add a little, not just... Add a little Zohar, add a little positive Jewish content, Zmiros, Divrei Torah, maybe go to a shir in the afternoon. So I guess the Orthodox can do that as well. But it's obviously big for the conservative movement and the reform movement. I don't know if the reform movement even speaks about this anymore. But in the conservative movement, there's been talk about the Sabbath. And that's really the reason why they permitted driving the synagogue on Saturday, because they thought if they don't bring the people in, they're not giving them any sense of a holy day. What are they going to do? They're not. They're just going to be home all day. So I thought that's important. They stress the sanctity of the Sabbath, make it a day holy, a day of religion. They don't speak about not working, because for the reformers, they are going to be going to work. It's just you have to deal with what you can. Among other issues they discussed was one that we also dealt with in a previous class. For a mourner in Avil, they ruled that you should no longer do kriya, tear kriya, rip a garment on the death of a family member. It was not thought to be dignified. We saw this with the conservative movement in the Lieberman classes, that they also thought it was not dignified. And you have a whole responsum that's from the Committee on Jewish Law. I read it to you, that permits those little black things that you put on and cut it. And I remember saying when I did this that I don't see what's so undignified. And we read what was written, how it shows that in larger society, it doesn't look appropriate in the society we're living in. And I asked, why are the conservative rabbis so concerned with the wider society? That's what we're judging. If we have a halacha that we have to do, we're now judging how it looks to the non-Jew who maybe will come visit you on Shiva. That to me was a low point, as I said, in the committee on Jewish law and standards. But I'm not sure what's so undignified. It's that they see it as some oriental, ancient oriental practice. You're going to tear your garment, or maybe it's not the tearing as much as sitting in the garment. But whatever it is, and they don't mention about having the little black thing and cutting that. You don't do it at all. And they also dealt with the holidays. And they decided, this shouldn't surprise anyone, Yom Tov Sheni is not required. There's no need for it. We have a calendar now. It never should have been instituted to begin with. It wasn't practiced in Germany anyway, so they got rid of it. And that remained to this day, the Reform Jewish practice. They don't have Yom Tov Sheni. Conservative still does. Brandeis University, my alma mater, adopted the Reform practice. That is, you got off the first day, not the second day, for whatever reason. I don't know if anyone, one of my teachers was Bernard Wasserstein, if anyone knows the name, who's written a number of books on European Jewish history. So one day he says to me that he's very opposed to this policy. He says, I'm an atheist, but I'm a nationalist. And if you're going to recognize the holidays, you got to recognize it in an authentic way. As a student there, it's always great. At least you got off those days. I can tell you, and those of you who have kids in secular colleges, you know that it's very hard with Rosh Hashanah and then Sukkot, missing all those days. What I find also significant, though, is that they didn't get rid of the second day of Rosh Hashanah. They kept the second day of Rosh Hashanah. Today, the Reform synagogues, to my knowledge, they all only practice one day. But in Germany, they kept the second day of Rosh Hashanah. And I find this significant because they could have made a good argument, I think, the same sort of argument with a stretch. How many of you know we just finished Rosh Hashanah? In the days of the Beis HaMikdash, when they were Mekadesh Chodesh, Rosh Hashanah was also 2 days. Except if you were in the place, the base area where the Beis Din was, where they came, and then the witnesses came. So let's say I'm in Jerusalem and the witnesses come and they testify on the 30th that they saw the new moon. So then I only need to keep one day. But outside, everywhere else, I have to keep 2 days because the messengers weren't sent to them. With the other holidays, the messengers would be sent. So by the middle of the month, we know that Rosh Hashanah. That we know that the new moon is either today or tomorrow, so they would know which day it was. And that's the practice in Eretz Yisrael, so 2 days. However, would it surprise you if I told you that from maybe the 4th century until 13th century, in Eretz Yisrael, they kept one day of Rosh Hashanah. One day. We have this testified to by Rav Haigon, the Rif says, and the Rif doesn't just add things unless it's in the Gemara, but he makes a point of this extra thing adding that in Eretz Yisrael you celebrate 2 days. So why is he making that point? Because he's agreeing with Rav Haigon that you don't do one day. And on the spot there, you look at the Baal HaMor, Rav Zerachi HaLevi, he points out that the practice in Eretz Yisrael is one day. And it was always the practice until people went on Aliyah. I think he says from Provence, if I'm not mistaken, there was an Aliyah. And they convinced the people in Eretz Yisrael, I don't exactly know how they convinced them, but because if this had been a practice of long standing, that they convinced the people from Eretz Yisrael to go to 2 days, because this was a machlokes. Maybe this goes back to the original calendar. I don't know. But so you could have made, and what's the svara, what's the logic here? That once you have a calendar, so in Chutz Arts, we say that we go minhag avoseinu, just like we always were 2 days, now we continue doing that. But in Eretz Yisrael, at least in the place where the witnesses came, it was one day, so they extended it to all of Eretz Yisrael. And so that they could have made the argument that, therefore, you see that really you only need one day, and now we have a calendar, and what's the difference between us here living in Germany and the people who are living far from Jerusalem? They, too, also wouldn't have found, the messengers wouldn't have reached them. So they could have made the argument, but they didn't. And
Ephraim Kanefogel has, Ephraim Kanefogel told Zachary, my son, that Byzantine minhag was one day, Rosh Hashanah. And there's even a question as to whether Kalir only celebrated one day.
And you're saying outside of Eretz Yisrael? This I've never heard. Yes. Sammy Sor says, I've never heard of outside of Eretz Yisrael. The Baal HaMor is clear, and there's a Rav Nissim Gaon of Karuan. You know where Karuan is?
Yes,
those are Karuan. It's in Tunisia. Where God will be next year. Unfortunately, there's not, since 40, 50 years, there's nothing left in Karuan Jewishly, but we will see where it was. Rav Nissim of Karuan, he writes to Rav Hai Gaon, and he wants to know why. Why, Rav Hai Gaon, you say it has to be 2 days, because in Eretz Yisrael, the practice was 1 day. I've never heard, Gershon, if you can send it to me,
I'll have Zachary send it to you.
Send it to me, thank you, and I'll report to the class, because I don't understand how that would work, because unless you make the argument, there are those who have said that Yom Tov Shein, that Rosh Hashanah's second day is, it's not about a suffake. It's a separate idea. 2 days or 1 day. And look, we have the whole discussion: is it Yom Arichta or not? That's why we do the Shechayanu on the second night with on the fruit to be or close to be Choshesh for the position that it's. It's 2 days or vice versa. I'm confused. I don't want to get into this. What do we hold? We hold Rashi that it's two separate days. So yeah, so we say separate Shechianu. But to hold for the position as Yom Arichta, we also have a piece of fruit. Okay, so I don't know how that would work, but you sent it to me. I'm happy to learn now because I haven't heard of that.
He even says that there's a question as to whether Kalir celebrated only one day.
Okay, well, that's also of interest. That I don't know as well. Thank you. We'll get to that. Kalir, who we assume is like what, 8th century, 7th century? I don't think we don't know that much about Kalir. The Tosafists think he lived, he was a Tana, right? But I'm just. We assume that the Rav also assumed he's much later. Okay, we really don't know where he lived, though. That's the thing. I'm just looking quickly online. I don't think we know where he lived, so it's hard to say. Maybe he was living in Eretz Yisrael. We don't know that much about him. I don't know. Okay. Some people think he lived in Eretz Yisrael, so I don't know. But I'll wait for that. Interestingly, at the Breslau meeting, Meyer records that one Reform rabbi even claimed that it was forbidden. I mean, he acts very pious here. He gets up and talks about how it's forbidden to observe a second day of Yom Tov. What does he say here? Actually, no, it's not. It's not in Meyer. It's in. I don't have it in front of me now. Rabbi Hirst Simmels in the Avram Weiss Jubilee volume has an article about Yom Tov Sheni, and he cites one of the Reform rabbis who acted so pious, saying it's usher to celebrate Yom Tov Sheni because that's you're adding on to the Torah. It's violating Baal Tosif. Had he made the argument that you don't want to celebrate Yom Tov Sheni because you can't wear tefillin, then that would be a decent argument, maybe. But to say Baal Tosif, how can you say Baal Tosif when all the great rabbis celebrated Yom Tov Sheni? But that's what he argued. This idea of Yom Tov Sheni, for some reason, it maybe it gets people upset today. I don't know. It's unless I like 2 days when it's a third day, when it's a 3-day Yontif. Okay, that's a bit much, I guess. But 2 days is fine. But it's been an issue. And even when the State of Israel was proclaimed, and there were people in Kibbutz Dati movement who thought that now we're going to revitalize Judaism and that we can make all sorts of changes. There were people arguing that we should get rid of Yom Tov Sheni. Tzimos actually mentions a couple of them in his article. But you even had this as an issue going back a couple hundred years. Let me share with you something here. Get rid of this. Oh, I see. I have the symbols. I print out the page, but okay. In Italy already, yes, of course, it's a big dispute between the Orthodox and the Reform, but in Italy, this became a big issue. I didn't include this really in earlier when we dealt with, because it's not really a Reform question as much, but if you look in Meir Ben-Ayahu, the great scholar Meir Ben-Ayahu, who I've mentioned on numerous occasions, extremely prolific, hundreds of articles, books, the expert in Jews in the Arab lands, on Sabbateanism, expert in so many areas. Unfortunately, at the not many years after his passing, his reputation took a hit. I don't know deserved or not, because in the best-selling book by Matti Friedman on the Aleppo Codex, he claims that the traditional view is that it was burnt, except for a tiny bit of the Pentateuch was destroyed and already in Aleppo, and the only thing we have is the rest of it. He provides evidence that there was a full Aleppo Codex even after it reached the land of Israel, and he casts suspicion, aspersions, that Meir Ben-Ayahu is responsible. He lifted it. He stole it. He's calling him a thief. And it's some claim, let me tell you, to me, of such a scholar like this, that he's a thief. And the response, as you can imagine, by the children, by others, was quite harsh. He was even, when Matti Friedman was brought in to speak on the Aleppo Codex in Brooklyn by the Syrians, the Syrian rabbis came out with a decree that it's forbidden to go hear him speak because of the way he defamed Meir Ben-Ayahu. Meir Ben-Ayahu was the son of Chief Rabbi Yitzhak Nissen. But if you're interested, you can take a look at it. But Meir Ben-Ayahu wrote a book, one of his many, called Yom Tov Sheni Shalagolios. Now, this is not a printing mistake, a typo, that Shin Lamed and Golios are connected. He's always writing this way because this is how the Rambam wrote. If you look in the Rambam, its shell is always connected to the next word. So Yom Tov Sheni Shel Golios, and it's all about the disputes over Yom Tov Sheni. And on page 36-37, he actually has the letter of the rabbis of Mantua. Why? Because the merchants of Mantua, and this year is, let me see the year here. Unfortunately, I didn't write what year down. It's in the letter. It's in letters. So it's in the early 19th century, as I recall. Mid 19th century. The merchants of Mantua said that we're having a hard time making a living here if we can't work on Yom Tov Sheni. And there some of them, I guess, were a bit learned, and they said there's no point for it. Now we have a calendar. And they said to the – listen what they said. So they said this to the rabbis that you have – please – no, we didn't say please. We ask you with all bakashot to permit for us Yom Tov Sheni, Lasoto Chol, Kmob Eretz HaKdosha, to make it as a regular day, just like in the land of Israel. But then they said, if Imlo Tishmu Eleinu Atir, they said this to the rabbis, if you rabbis in Mantua, there are two rabbis in Mantua, I don't know if there's still there's a synagogue in Mantua, I don't know if there's still a community there, but they said to them, Imlo Tishmu Eleinu Atir, if you do not mutter this for us, that we will the chazaka. We will take the heter with strength. That is, rabbis, we're giving you the opportunity to be matur it for us. And if you don't matur it for us, we are going to do it anyway. It's interesting. Go to your local rabbi and say, ask him, is this kosher? And if you don't permit it, we're going to do it anyway. Yeah. Well, the rabbis were very upset with this, and they sent out a letter, which the original copy of the original is published in the book, to rabbis all throughout Europe, Ashkenazi and Sephardi, asking, you know, to how send us letters, because if you send us letters, then we can show the community that all the great rabbis say you can't get rid of Yom Tov Sheni. Benayahu also mentions this point that I found significant, that in a later time, when the Jews of Italy were definitely less traditional, the end of the 19th century, in 1899, now 1899, most Jews of Italy were assimilated. I shouldn't say assimilated. There were many who were intermarrying, but they were not observant, most Jews of Italy. And there were no Talmidei Chachamim in Italy then. And it really, it had fallen on very low times. And the issue came up again in Ancona. In Torino, in Turin, in Italy, that a group of individuals sent around a petition to be Mevatel Yom Tov Sheni. Now, the rabbi in Torino said that if the members of the community did this, he's going to resign from his position. What was the community? The community leaders of Torino who wanted to get rid of Yom Tov Sheni, this is on, you can see this on page 61 in Benayahu's book, said, we're going to take a vote by the community. All members of the community, I'm not sure if it means men and women, but all members of the community will vote. And if you don't vote no, that is an opposition to get rid of Yom Tov Sheni, your vote will count as a yes. So abstention counts as a yes. They're really stacking the decks here. So in 1899, they have the vote. And listen to this. Out of 250 people who voted, 245 voted against getting rid of Yom Tov Sheni. And then they had to declare that since the community voted against it, they're not getting rid of it. These are people, they're not observant. That is, they're not Shomer Shabbos. But they're like the old-fashioned Sephard. You remember the typical Sephardic Jew, who maybe in their own life is not observant, but they know the synagogue they go to is the observant synagogue, and they never would dream of having anything looking reform. I mean, you tell a Sephardic rabbi about things that in the open Orthodox or in liberal Orthodox you do, everything from women's rabbis, other things. No, they want everything. They don't have to do it, but they want the people who do it to do it properly. So here you have Italy. 245 out of 250, the only people I guess disagreed with, the machers who did it, they all say that, no, we want to keep Yom Tov Sheni. I guess it's very easy to keep Yom Tov Sheni because they're not really observing it. They'll go to synagogue in the morning, but then they'll go and do what they want to do. So that's interesting, I think. And finally, no, you know, it's already, I see it's about almost 9:25. What we'll pick up next time, then sum it up about these rabbinic conferences, because that's it. No more rabbinic conferences. Why no more rabbinic conferences? And I want to read you a summary of how Michael Meyer sees the significance of these conferences, really as creating a reform movement. And then next class, which may be the last one, a little bit about the Orthodox response. And to maybe take it to a close, if not that class, the class after, Abraham Geiger and in Breslau also. Abraham Geiger is appointed rabbi by the community in Breslau and appointed to serve on the dayan with the Orthodox rabbi. Well, an Orthodox rabbi is going to serve together with Abraham Geiger. So the big machlokes that happens in Breslau and the fascinating thing, which I discovered, which no one knows about, because wait till you hear where I found this, the tradition in Breslau, what the Orthodox did because of Geiger. And maybe so, if not next class, we'll finish up to class after that. So let me take the comments and the questions here. I'm happy to be back tonight. Someone says I'm using Wi-Fi. That might be the reason. I'm not using Wi-Fi. I have a new computer here, and for some reason, and the sound works fine, but for some reason, when I share the screen, I don't think it has to do with all the people on the 60 or 50 people. For some reason, when I share the screen, it doesn't, the sound doesn't come out properly, which is crazy because sharing the screen shouldn't have any effect on anything. It's just your screen. Oh, so Howard says, not really Hirschsprung. This is Rabbi Hirschhorn. We're talking in the 50s. Yeah, Rabbi Hirschhorn is prior to Rabbi Hirschsprung. He's called on the, I'll read you what it says on the front page of the Sefer. I don't have the Sefer, but I have it on, I just found it today on Otsar HaChachma, so I printed it out. He's called on the front page of the Sefer, let's see, Rabbi Yeshua ben Sender HaLevi, Chief Rabbi, Jewish Community Council. So I guess that means Chief Rabbi. Ellie says, the anti-Israel policy of the New York Times stem from their owners being staunch Reform Jews. By the way, is that true today? Are they considered Reform, or they're just nothing?
Because,
I don't know. I mean, they come from German, from Reform stock. But I'd like to know that if you look at the statistics today, it's got to be 40% of the Jews today in America are not Orthodox, not conservative, not Reform. That is none of the above. Either secular, and even for the younger generation, non-Jewish and Jewish, you have the nuns. That's the largest. Do you know that's from 18 to 29, the largest religious group in America? If you separate Catholic and Protestant, the largest religious group in America is the nuns, N-O-N-E. That is none of the above. And by the way, they're not atheists. It's not like Europe. The atheist and agnostic are a small number. They're what we call spiritual, but not religious. And that's you have that among many of the Jews as well. So I don't know. Are the Reform today? Are they identify as Reform or just identify as secular American Jews? I know in Canada. Yeah. What?
I believe that the family has converted a number of generations ago.
They do not consider themselves Jewish.
Not even halakhically Jewish. They're not halakhically Jewish. Okay. There you go, Mel. I see it. Yeah, they don't even consider themselves Jewish. But are they? I know there's a lot of intermarriage. I wonder if there's any halachic Jews still involved in that paper. So Rabbi Kelman says that in Toronto, sunrise would be 9 a.m. in midwinter and worse in Detroit. Yeah, it's not such an issue in New York. But as you go west in time zones, like the western part of the eastern time zone, it creates a big problem. But you have to ask yourself what to do about this, because you're not going to – the whole – like a whole state is not going to change what they think is a better policy because of prayers, which I can't even understand. What's the difference? Why can't you pray a little better, a little later, or the idea of a minion? So I think, you know, if there's a better argument, and if there's not a better argument, then this is what happens, then we'll have to figure out.
School safety.
Yeah, you don't want kids going to the bus stop at dark, in darkness. Right. That's the argument. But they didn't do that. They were arguing about prayer. At least one of them was arguing prayer. And so I don't know. We'll have to you can daven before sunrise if you need to. But again, how much before sunrise? If you can start, it's still a problem. If the absolute earliest is 8 o'clock, it's still a problem.
I really hope they don't do it. Let's put it that way.
It could destroy the daily minion in many cities.
Right.
In 1973, we had a daven in the office. They kept daylight savings time when there was the oil crisis.
Right.
Yeah, so maybe we'll come up with new things that people come into work earlier, and then the boss knows that, like, at 8:30, like in New York, it's not a problem. Everyone will gather a certain place in office buildings. They do it for Mincha. They'll do it for Shacharis. Maybe they'll have to bring back the Rambam's idea to Hecha Kedusha for Shacharis, which we don't ever do, but maybe there is to have to come up with something. But I don't know. Here's my example, like with the metric system. I think it works fine the way we have it. Why change something that works okay? So that's also a good argument, Rabbi Kelman. Don't.
I'm with you. I like changing back choice here, no problem. But I will tell you, we can do the Menachem Liebtag approach. When he spoke about in Toronto, he mentioned that he came on a trip in the winter and he was davening at 6 a.m. So he was staying at the Grisman's, if you know Rabbi Grisman, of course. So they told him, what are you doing? Can't daven at 6. It's like an hour before Amud HaShachar. Then what are you talking about? I've been up for 3 hours. It's shachar. And he said, apparently 40%, some crazy number, like 40% of Israelis don't work in the time zone they live in. You know, in today's world with Zoom, you can work, live somewhere and work in different. And he was raising the possibility. He said, you need, you know, that maybe Shachrit shouldn't go by time. It should go by when you get up. In other words, when B'Shachrit has nothing to do with whether.
No, because
I know people don't say that, but I'm just.
No, but it doesn't make any sense because in the days of Gomorrah, people got up early also. The whole idea has to do with the time. It has nothing to do with getting up.
I will tell you, Rav Schachter once quoted an opinion. I believe it's a Pnei Yoshua, but I'm not certain that you can rely on streetlights. Before electricity, you had to wait till sunrise. Today, you have streetlights, you can use that. So I'm not saying that's accepted opinion, but these are the type of opinions that might have to come into play.
That's interesting.
Once this happens. Anyway, sorry.
So Eric says that many Reform synagogues still have Rosh Hashanah 2 days. Okay, I didn't know. That's because when I was in college, they told us the Reform group there only had 1 day. And Mel says in the Beis Hamikdash, they often kept 2 days. Yes, that the witnesses didn't come before Chatzos. Okay, and Susanna mentions, of course, that, again, that's the real argument. Kids are waiting for the bus when it's dark. That's the only argument that could be a winning argument. So I see we're at the end. Wish everyone Gemar Chasima Tova and a very good holiday. I work at a Catholic university. I'll add one more thing. The non-Jews don't get it. They because of Hanukkah, the same time as Christmas, so that for them, Hanukkah has become such a big holiday. In America, it has. You can't even call it a Christmas party, holiday parties. And the wishes I get from my colleagues, have a nice Hanukkah, they think it's like so big. And they have two holidays. They have Christmas and Easter. That's their big thing. I have to explain to them, of course, that that's a minor holiday, that our big holidays are these other holidays. Families get together, all these things. And that these are... And the idea is that, we're together with families and we have all this time. I say to them that it's not just the holidays. We have Thanksgiving every single Friday night. We have Thanksgiving dinner. I mean, they don't really appreciate all the holidays that we have. So we have 2 days. And, many of us will have our families together with us. So unlike those the Socharim and the merchants in Mantua and the Reform who wanted to get rid of Yom Tov Sheni, I think that we can enjoy Yom Tov Sheni. And I wish you all the best. Have a great holiday. And I'll see you, God willing, in a few weeks. And Rabbi Kelman, take it away.
Okay, thank you very much. Want to wish everybody Gemar Chatima Tova. Should be a good year for personally, nationally, and internationally for the world at large. And that's we pray for everything. So everybody, Gemar Chatima Tova. I hope people are mocha me. I interrupt sometimes. I talk too much, but whatever. I have the buttons here to control everything. So whatever. So I hope people mocha me. We look forward to a wonderful year, hopefully, and learning and all kinds of things in all our lives. We continue Thursday night. Will be our next year, Parsha Shir. Daniel Friedman, Rabbi Daniel Friedman, the Teaneck Jewish Center, will be giving the Parsha Shir, and then I'll be giving my Shir on the Siddur, which this week we'll do on some of the special Sukkah Stavning, please God, on Friday morning, 9:30. And then And then that's it, right? Sukkos will be off. Rabbi Liebdag will not be teaching Erev Sukkos. And okay, we'll look forward to learning with you, and everybody will. Gemar Chatima Tova. Thank you very much. Okay, be well.